Okay, thank you. Because I tend to ramble, I did write some notes that I could go off of in this share. So I am Paula D. I am a compulsive eater. My little postage stamp on the three-legged stool before I came into OA, or really more realistically, before I became my recovery path, my physical weight was 280 pounds and I'm 5'2". Emotionally, I was probably about 12 years old, although I certainly didn't think so at the time. And I was agnostic then. I'm still an agnostic, but I have a higher power that works for me. So, what it was like, what I was like. I've come to think more very recently, something happened that made me really contemplate, is my compulsive eating a function of nature or nurture, or a little bit of both? I don't know. And at the end of the day, it probably doesn't matter. Well, the big book says knowledge avails us nothing. I happen to believe it avails us some stuff, but it's of a limited benefit to know is it nature or nurture. But what I do know is this: I have generations of ancestors who were alcoholics or compulsive eaters. So we were, lots of the isms in the gene pool there. Every single one of my siblings, and I have seven, are like me. They have some sort of an ism. We generally have gone between eating or drinking, one of those two, occasionally both. There's also addiction in the generation that follows mine. Growing up, though, I didn't know anything about addictions or 12-step programs. I didn't know how the behaviors of my great-grandparents, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles and parents might permeate every aspect of my thinking and relating to the world. Was there some dysfunction in my growing up years in my family? Well, sure. But as I look back, I'd say it was far more good than not. So, although I was born almost, in my view, although I was almost surely born with the predilection for an addiction, it didn't erupt until I was an adolescent. But even before there was food, I already had two mechanisms to separate myself from the realities of life. One was reading, and one was fantasizing. I was a champion daydreamer. And so, both reading and fantasizing, as I said, those were my original drugs of choice. But from the very start, maybe I had a negative body image, but I don't recall being obsessed by it, and I don't even know where it came from. That there was no overt activity that comes to my mind that resulted in that. I just that's it was just there. When I hit adolescence, I felt larger than other girls. Although when I look at photographs of that time, what I see is a girl who was slender. And then later in my adolescence, I wasn't so slender, but I was still within the range of a healthy body weight. It is possible I developed an abnormal focus on food and body image when I was in seventh or eighth grade. I had a new best friend, Janice. She was obese, but I didn't know anything at that time about compulsive eating or fasting or anything like that. Janice introduced me to the pleasure of binge eating. She also introduced me to fasting, and to 500 calorie a day dieting. I didn't know about either of those things. She did not cause my eating disorder. Okay. She just happened to show me a new form of entertainment. And that's how I viewed it at that time. It was fun, binge eating, especially the tasty kinds of things that she had at her house that we did not have at my house. It was fun. It was luxurious. It was delicious. If a different friend had introduced me to alcohol or chemicals instead, maybe I'd have gone with one of those or both of them instead of the food. But it was during my first marriage, and I've been married twice. It was during my first marriage that I transformed from a bit of a plump woman to an obese one. And as I said, my top weight was 280 pounds. Food was no longer a form of light entertainment, it was a tonic for unhappiness and stress. Now, at a certain point, we d divorced. But divorce did not cause weight to drop. I was absolutely a compulsive eater. For the next 2 decades, the acquisition of a wall of fat effectively removed the need to deal with, to me, this bewildering and intimidating attention of men, something I had never learned from my mom or my dad or my friends. It wasn't until I was in my 40s and 50s that I learned some things about myself that maybe most people learn way younger. Although I thought I was, I always thought I was a strong person, I was actually riddled with fears. And these fears are what drove my thinking and my actions. I was a martyr, I was a victim. All, as I mentioned earlier, all of my siblings were addicts in some manner. And several of them, my siblings, behind closed doors with their families, were not the charming people they appeared to be in public and to the rest of our family. As I said, emotionally, I was probably only about 12. And this realization, when I did finally get it, explained a lot of things to me, both socially and professionally. And it was sort of like the way I like it to think of it is, it seemed like everyone around me had gotten this rule book to life, and I didn't get it until I entered into the 12-step program. It's like, oh, okay, now I get some things. Spiritually, although I was an agnostic, I did have a higher power. In fact, I had several higher powers. They were food, fear, the approval of other people, and childhood scripts that I didn't know I was reading from. These higher powers are what drove my thinking and my actions. So, and I would also say too that, that wall of fat that I had around me, on one hand, it was a protection. It was kind of like Rapunzel up in the tall castle. I wanted someone to save me. Again, I was a martyr and a victim, and I fantasized daydreams, all those things. But at the other hand, what I noted is that when this is my story, okay, others may differ, but when I'm a walking wall of fat, people don't did not see me as a woman, certainly. I was just this, I lost my personhood in a way. And that was just a reality. So what happened? It was sometime in the 1990s is when I began my lifelong recovery plan. I don't have a specific date. It doesn't have relevance to me any certain date. So I don't, I, what I generally say is I began a number of years ago on this recovery path. I've been abstinent for a number of years. I've been a healthy body weight for a number of years. But I can say sometime in the 1990s is when I began walking a recovery path. And that preceded Overeaters Anonymous. I was scared toward recovery when a friend of mine had a debilitating stroke in her 50s. And even though she'd been warned by a doctor that she was at risk for a stroke because of some of the usual red flags, she was unable to make the changes necessary to reduce her risk, which is the norm for us, right? I was at my top weight of 280 pounds. But a subsequent event that scared me really moved me toward program, and that was a particular night of binging. And I do make brief mention of some specific food here. I had made a pot. I'm a volume eater. I'm also a more savory eater. Sugar is not my thing. I'm not so much into sugar. I had made a big pot of spaghetti with meat sauce, one of my favorite binge foods. It was easy to make. It was cheap for me to make. Tasted good, and again, lots of volume, visually and in actuality. To accompany the spaghetti, I had sleeves, not just a sleeve, but sleeves of saltine crackers, with also a room temperature stick of margarine. And that's what the binge would be about. So my usual binge practice was to eat so much food that my stomach would hurt. Then I would lay down on my stomach to provide relief from the pain when I no longer felt pain and no longer felt stuffed. Because who cares if I was full or not? That would completely, who cares? That has no relevance. So when I no longer felt stuffed, I would resume the binge. But on this particular evening, I felt the usual pain eventually, resumed eating the pot of spaghetti after the first round of pain subsided. But at the end of my second round, my stomach was so distended and the pain was so acute that I thought as I retired from the bed that I might die that night. I mean, I was really scared. My daughter was only about 7 years old and I was a single parent. And that night, as I feared death, I thought about what would happen to my daughter. And I was, as I said, I was really afraid. I wasn't sure I'd wake up in the morning. And that's, one would think then the very next day I'd run into some kind of something, something. No, I didn't, because I'm kind of was a typical addict, all right? But it did It was an impetus to get me toward there. So that year I sought a better light. And for me, in a sense, I sought a light. And that's been all along for me, the promise of being happy, joyous, and free. That's been my vision from the very start. And that is my vision today, happy, joy, to be happy, joyous, and free. My recovery has never been like a happy Girl Scout tripping up to my door to deliver it to me. My experience has been that I've got to go into the woods, hunt it down, kill it, and drag it home. But as I said, I started before recovery, before OA. I found a book on health that made sense to me, written by someone who blended a certain way of eating with emotional, mental health and spirituality, and so that was my beginning of acting on my recovery journey. Along the way, I reached plateaus of weight loss, and at each plateau, I had to make a change, and that still holds true for me today. If I play plateau or get complacent, I got to make a change. So the first plateau, I moved my body board. The second plateau, I may have sought counseling for the first time. The third time I plateaued, that's when I sought out OA. But in the community where I lived, the sole OA meeting was a very weak meeting, and it was sort of five women sitting around a table and giving a number of how good the previous week was, and that they'll do better next week. But I had nothing to bring to the table because I didn't have any experience with 12-step programs. But I just felt like, there was nothing here for me. But I continued moving forward the best I could. At a certain point, and I'm going to briefly mention another fellowship because it's part of my OA program. So at a certain point, I began to attend open AA meetings. And that is where I learned more about what it means to live in a new way without picking up the drug, in our case, food. I witnessed a woman who struggled daily with her bipolar w illness, who was having a terrible time getting the dosage right of her meds. And often at these meetings, she would just sob. And even though it's been a lot of years, it still affects me. She kept coming back. The woman kept coming back. There were people at the table who'd been diagnosed with brain cancer, a woman with a wicked case of COPD. There were couples with family tragedies, but they did not pick up their drug of choice. They talked about working the steps. I remember one meeting, there was this biker dude and he wears black leather and a pocket chain, and he told us what his sponsor told him. You'll have to climb over the bodies of those who die in order to stay in recovery. And that's just as true in OA as it is in AA. So those have really stuck with me. I learned a couple of other kind of shocking things in those open meetings. And again, I apply all of these to my OA program. Okay. Number one, the shocking thing was we judge ourselves by our intentions, but others judge us by our actions. It's like, oh. And also, dwelling on our low self-esteem is just another example of being self-absorbed. And that's one of those things that, there's that slogan out there, the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off. Like, well, wait, how can low self-esteem be self-absorption? But yeah, okay, so it's true. For a while, my only OA connection was through the asynchronous email loops, in case anyone remembers those. I got my first sponsor from one of those loops. He fired me. He gave me another, and his parting words to me, we bury the smart ones. Because apparently I ask too many questions. But that's also true. Sometimes I'm really an analytical person, and there's kind of this joke saying a sponsor tells a sponsee, yeah, go read the chapter called Figure It Out. And of course there is no chapter saying I'm going to figure it out. So what I had to do was, when it came to OA, and being the analytical person that I am, and other things. So, as an analytical person and an agnostic, I had to make a decision that OA was good enough. It's good enough. It didn't have to be perfect for me to adopt it as a guide to living. My best thinking got me to 280 pounds. I don't have to reinvent the wheel, create some new recovery operation. I've heard from OA fellows that OA is a voluntary brainwash, and I'm good with that. I choose to make OA work for me. So those are things that have really helped me. In this, as I mentioned, in the spiritual dimension, I began as an agnostic and I'm still an agnostic. Okay, 5 minutes, got it. Let's see, let me skip through a little bit. It took me 2 years to work through steps 6 and 7, with fear being the predominant characteristic to work through. And during that time, I learned that my brain does not care what chemicals wash over it, whether they're the pleasurable endorphins or if I'm it all caught up in resentments and rewriting history in my brain and getting all worked up with the negative stuff. My brain just eats that stuff up. It just wants the rush of chemicals. It doesn't care if they're just as tasty. The negative ones are just as tasty as the pleasurable ones. So what it is like now is I strive to be a grown up. It gives me pleasure to be an adult. I do still struggle with selfishness and self-absorption. Emotional sobriety continues to be a challenge for me. I'm finding that pockets of victimhood linger, and these can get in the way of my emotional sobriety. But I keep my eyes on the prize, which again is to be happy, joyous, and free. I've got to comp to be to get there. I have to complete the task of completely rewiring my brain, that so-called psychic change, rewiring my attic. Rewiring an actual attic in a house is expensive. It's tedious work that doesn't show on that on the outside, like, a beautifully remodeled kitchen, or one's healthy body weight. But it's got to be done, or the house can burn down. And the way I look at my recovery is, and this is for me again, other people have different views on it, different experiences of it. I am not recovered. I'm in remission. The treatment actions I take. So step one to me is absolutely pivotal. I am powerless over food, but I am not powerless over the treatment actions I take, which include going to meetings, sponsoring, a food plan, action plan, phone calls, writing, all of those things. Those are the treatment actions I do have control over, and they will help keep me in remission. As I heard another OA person say one time, the woman I was will relapse. So, hopefully I'm a different woman than I was before. With the little bit of time I have left, I from the very beginning, so if I kind of talk around to the food part, the action, the food plan. Well, for one, my abstinence definition is just the OA definition. Okay, refraining from compulsive eating, working toward or sustaining a healthy body weight. I have my food plan. I decided early on that if I have to fight with my food plan, I'm going to lose because step one, okay, I'm powerless over food. So I started out with a food plan I knew I could succeed at, and I still do that. I also have come to understand that just because a particular food plan worked for me in the past doesn't mean it'll work for me today. I can't just keep going. I have to be willing to change. If something isn't working now, then I have to make a change. And I'm no different than a lot of people who discover the path gets a little bit narrower. In my scenario, I'm a liar, a denier, a cheater. So I have to do certain things to keep me, to provide objective data. So for me, I have to weigh myself so I can look to see what's on the scale because I'm a liar, denier, cheater. I happen to have a caloric envelope out of my food because that's what is works for me. Let's see. I also have to, there's a lot of nutritional noise out there for normal people. For me to succeed in my treatment plan, my food plan, I've got to eat what and when and where and how for what allows me to follow my food plan. So what the time of day that I eat is not necessarily going with what other people might do. Again, I got to work with the food plan that's good for me. I think that's good. Of course, I always have way more to say, but that's good for now. And I thank you so much for this opportunity to share with you, and I look forward to hearing other people's shares. Thank you.